Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Yeah, you know, I've been offering garden advice for a long time. And I think, I wonder why I did it. I wonder how I got into it. What did I want out of it? You know, it's an interesting thing because I didn't make much money in it. Never been good at doing that, apparently. But I did okay, and I eat very well. Let me tell you, I eat very well. And that's one of the most important things. I eat very well because I got a great garden. Because I know how to use it. I'm learning every day how to use it better. But there it is. But what did I want out of giving this garden advice? Because it didn't bring any money. Wasn't a great career. You know what I wanted to do was to make sure that was to be in a place where people understood where they are and took advantage of it, and to build a great gardening city, to help build a great city that understood its place in the world and its uniqueness and how much could be done with those gardens. And now it's time for you to take that and make use of it. Take the basics and run with it. And to begin building this city, because it's too late for me. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. It now belongs to another generation. And it's nice to begin thinking about how do I make sure that this next generation is prepared to do the things that my generation wasn't smart enough to do. Didn't care enough to do. So this is why we're on the basics. I want you to understand the basics. A lot of very good things we're talking about. What is needed in the soil? But first, I have to answer Dan's question. Dan, because you've asked that question several times, the music that we played about being stuck here in Chicago, that's Taj Mahal and Keb Mo. You know Taj Mahal. Taj Mahal and Keb Mo had a collaboration. Great little album. That's one of the pieces off of it. There you go. So let's go back, because Greg had an interesting point. We're taught in grammar school that plants absorb carbon dioxide and then produce oxygen. And this is true. Most plants are net producers of oxygen. That is, they produce more oxygen than they consume. But they need oxygen. And Greg's back with us. And so I wanted to clarify this. Greg, let's just talk about this thing and the oxygen and carbon dioxide and why it's so important to think about with plants. Every part of a plant needs oxygen to work. It requires not only carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is directly used in the photosynthetic process. So when plants do photosynthesis, they need carbon dioxide, but they also need oxygen. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Just pure old oxygen. And that's the above-ground parts of the plants. There's never any problem with that. When respiration, plants respire. Plants have two modes. It's photosynthesis and respiration. When photosynthesis declines, respiration increases and begins to consume carbohydrates out of the plants. But respiration always requires oxygen, and plants need respiration. So they need carbon dioxide, but they also need oxygen. Above ground, that's not a problem, because if they didn't have oxygen above ground, there wouldn't be any people either. So there's always plenty of oxygen above ground. Below ground, plants desperately need oxygen because they need much more oxygen than they need carbon dioxide because there's no photosynthesis going on down below in the ground, right? All the photosynthesis is happening up above ground. That's where the carbon dioxide is needed. But below ground, there's a desperate need for oxygen. And there's some carbon dioxide used down there, and they actually exhale carbon dioxide. So there's a need for gas exchange going on down in the ground between those roots. There needs to be space
in the Army
for
National Guard.
And that's what we're kind of thinking about. Does that make sense, Greg?
Yeah, and they also get oxygen from water along with other nutrients. So it's a complicated process. It's not just the sun shines, the rains, and it grows. There's a lot of things entailed. Like you said, people go out and till up their soil for a garden, and it's loose and looks real nice for a while. But then with some rain, it gets impacted, and you still need to break the soil up so it can get some air.
That's right. That's right. So, and then it becomes impractical. So let's come back. It's a very another interesting thing. So you brought up another interesting point. You know, a lot of plants. So I've seen plants survive a lot of water, but only when that water is entrailed, when oxygen is entrailed in that water column. So when if you've ever kept plants on your windowsill. And you took cuttings, and they rooted out, and after a while, and they did fine for a while with just the water in the jar that you had on your windowsill. They put out new roots, they rooted out, but then after a while, the plants start declining, and they get rots, and they get other problems. And basically, that's because there's no oxygen left in that water. So one of the things we say to do is make sure that is to change the water out, because when you change the water out, you entrail some more oxygen in there, and plant root processes can go on a little better than they did before. It's still a problem, but it's better. And the same thing happens underground. So if oxygen is entrailed, O2 as pure oxygen. If it's entrailed in the water that's in the soil, that's good too. But most of the times it isn't. And so here's what. So Greg, you brought up a great case. So there it is. Let's say it again. So what Greg said was somebody's going to till the ground, and it fluffs it up a little bit because you've incorporated some air between each of those individual soil particles. But there's no structure keeping those, and so it sort of briefly puffs it up. But there's no spaces, but there's nothing to hold that structure in place anymore. Before you tilled it, there were things that held structures in place. There was the glue that soil creatures create that hold particles together. But you broke all those apart. You fluffed the soil up. And so for about, I would say in our climate, for about two rains, it's going to stay fluffed up. But by the third rain, and that happens a lot here, the soil has begun to collapse dramatically. And actually by about the fourth or fifth rain, it's tighter. It's tighter than it was before you tilled because all those soil particles now have collapsed with no structure to hold them apart, no spaces between the soil particles, very little space between the soil particle, much less than what you had. And so then you can't till it again because you got plants growing there now.
Well, that's why you need a garden fork.
There you go. Thank you. So there you go. So that's what we do. So, Greg, what I would really love to do, because the garden fork works well, And so what Greg and I are talking about is a garden fork is just this. It looks like a dinner fork, except it's much bigger. It stands about chest high, and you wiggle it into the ground, even in hard soils, and you just lean back on it, and you crack that soil down to about, maybe 12, 15 inches.
Yeah, whatever.
Yep, and you can get it down there, and then you've got it cracked, but you didn't turn it into powder. You didn't lose the structure that's already in that soil. You lift it out, and then you go to the next spot, and you crack it again. And so that way you've cracked it, you've allowed oxygen to diffuse in, you've allowed water to diffuse in to a greater depth without totally breaking up the soil structure. And you do that once, and then you put the organic matter in there, and then the soil creatures can manage it very, very well. And they're the ones then that can keep the spaces open that allow oxygen and water if they have something to feed on, and that's that organic matter, and that's why it becomes very important. You can't do that on a golf course, though, can you? It doesn't work quite as well. Yeah, go ahead.
We do some stuff that makes some holes in the ground, but we use the plugs that come out, what plugs are left, putting in areas that are bare spot, dump them there, and eventually they'll start growing.
So, yeah.
As long as they don't wash away.
That's right. Well, and so it's... You know, I often hear people say, well, I'm going to put on my golf shoes with cleats on them just to aerate the soil. But
yeah, that don't work.
That don't work.
Yeah. Walk out there barefooted, you do just as much.
Yeah. And it just doesn't work. What you really need to do, and I keep saying it, and if you've got a machine that goes down 6 inches, I think it can be effective. I like cracking, you know, I like making sure that the hard pan is broken down to about 12 inches, 10 to 11 to 12 inches, and I do that once and then come back over it. And I think things hold up there pretty well, even with our rainfall, as long as you're putting organic matter on top. And there may be some other things you can do to keep that soil open, but it's the soil creatures that do it. On a golf course or in a lawn, it's harder to do because there isn't enough organic matter being brought back into the soil. Do y'all do anything to add organic matter to the soil on those golf courses?
No. You're talking about like leaves and such?
Yeah.
No, we usually blowing those leaves off so the golfers can find their ball.
That's right. So you get into a real deficit. It's a very difficult thing to manage a golf course. I respect the fact that it is that you guys know how to do it. It's hard. I think, and I don't think people realize how much goes into a golf course in terms of managing, because you can't, you're lacking that organic matter. It's not being returned in the same way.
An everyday affair.
Yeah, and you know, it would be great if you could keep golfers off of it for about 2 or 3 weeks and put some pine bark on there and let the pine bark sort of settle in, but you can't do that, can you?
So, sometimes, in August, we're going to aerate the greens and some other areas. So 1-9 will be closed for a week, and you'd be surprised on what just a week will do.
Yeah. And it's tricky managing a golf course. It's interesting, and I really would like to. I haven't seen good experiments that demonstrated this. Good research. I decided, you know, that there really should be a way for the average homeowner to do this in their yards. And so I did get these. So I'll tell you what I got. They got these little augers. Oh, they're about, I guess they're the equivalent of a half-inch auger, maybe three-quarter-of-an-inch auger. And I put it on my drill. And I went to some compacted areas that I knew had been compacted. And it didn't have a hard pan. It had grass on top of it. The grass wasn't doing that well. And I would drill a series of holes that were pretty close together. But, you know, not destroying the grass in the process. I didn't see any difference. I couldn't really see that there was a lot of difference. It didn't make the kind of difference that cracking the soil usually would. But there may be something, and if Greg, if you ever see, because I would love to see that, what kind of plugs actually make the most difference? And I keep looking for that research.
What size diameter was your bit?
Yeah, it was. That's right. So it's about a 3/4 inch auger, and
ours are only maybe not quite maybe 3/8.
That's right, and
but they're much closer together.
That's right. So
we can't tell when we go in a certain direction if you overlap a little bit. When they finally grows back, the places that got double plugged, they turn out greener.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
So it got more. Actually, got more soil plugged from it, but it turned out greener.
Yeah. Charlie, if I got to take a break,
yeah,
Charlie's going to make me take a break here, Greg.
Okay. Well, before you run, just look up Google. Are we a shortage of CO2? There's a couple of scientists that say in a couple of decades we can't feed the earth.
Huh? Because of a shortage of CO2.
That's right. Hmm. He points out several places. Him and another guy.
Generally, yeah. Now that's. That's confounding, but I'll take a look at that, see what that's about. Yeah.
All right.
Good to talk to you, Greg. Thanks.
You too.
All right. Hey, we're going to take a break. We're going to be right back.
I ain't going to pick no peas because everything is going to get down. On your bended knees, I ain't going to dig no more taters. I declare I ain't gonna pick no peas because everything is on the phone. You know you got to go. I'll get down on your bended knee.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. And a lot of interesting discussions this morning. CO2, carbon dioxide. Is there a shortage of carbon dioxide? You know, it is very interesting. There has been, for industries, a brief shortage of carbon dioxide because carbon dioxide in its pure form that's in used in canisters, for example, to give the fizz to beers. They use it for lots of things. It gives fizz to beers. It gives fizz to your Coca-Cola. So it's been harder to procure that. It's a marketing thing, basically, because it's a byproduct of certain things, and you have to ship it from one place to another. It's a byproduct of making, if I'm not mistaken, it's a byproduct of making fertilizers. So they bottle it and they ship it. And so there has been a shortage of carbon dioxide there. Isn't that kind of weird? Because, of course, in the air, carbon dioxide is more abundant now than ever, or at least certainly in a very long time. We'd probably have to go back to the Jurassic period, maybe Cretaceous. Maybe to the Eocene, which is 30 million years ago, 40 million years ago, which is a long time ago, reasonably long time ago. There wouldn't be many things you would recognize in the Eocene. There'd still be some oaks around. They wouldn't be the same oaks, but it would be all kind of weird things. The Eocene was the last time carbon dioxide levels were this high, if I'm not mistaken. So it's certainly back during one of those ancient eras. And so we've got a lot more carbon dioxide now than we've had in quite a while in the atmosphere. What does that mean for plants? I will tell you that we don't know yet. And one of the projects I'm working on, and I'm working on it in North Alabama, is a forest research project, and we've got a lot of scientists. We've got Smithsonian Institution. We've got UCLA and Alabama A&M. Alabama, University of Alabama is going to be participating. University of Georgia is going to be participating. We're setting up some great experiments, and I'll talk to you more about them as we do it, to sort of understand what is going to happen with all this excess carbon dioxide. What's it going to do to forests? How's it going to change forests? How are forests going to respond to it? Are they going to take more of it up? Is it going to change, you know, certain things like maybe vines may be able to take more advantage of carbon dioxide than trees can. So what does that do to the forest? It's an interesting question. It's an interesting question. We're going to try to answer that and a lot of other questions in this big experiment we're doing in North Alabama Forest. It could change the way we think about forest, I expect, before it's all done. But these are big questions. But we're back to your garden and your soil. And the thing I wanted to leave you with, the thing I wanted you to understand, the thing that's most important is that soil needs oxygen, not just immediately after you dig it or till it, if that's what you did, but over the long haul. And oxygen, to get oxygen into that soil, and particularly in our house, can I talk about, we have rainfall here. I mean, we get a lot of rainfall. You know, 70 inches of rainfall a year? People don't even know. Most people in the world can't imagine that. They can't imagine that much rainfall. We get a ton of rainfall here, more than any other city in the U.S. Mobile does. And that's most of the Gulf Coast, from New Orleans back all the way back to Tallahassee. The northern Gulf Coast gets a ton of rainfall. When you're getting that much rainfall, it also tends to compact the soil. And not only does it make the spaces between the soil particles more narrow, there's less space between soil particles, but it also fills up whatever space is there. And so there's no oxygen left. This is the big problem. This is the biggest problem in our soils on the Gulf Coast. There's no space for oxygen in those soils. It's a problem everywhere, but it's a particular problem because of all of our rainfall. So how do we, this is what I keep stressing. You don't need to worry about nitrogen until you've figured out how to maximize the amount of oxygen in your soil, because if you don't have the oxygen in the soil, if you don't have room for gas exchange, if there's not room between your soil particles, it don't matter how much nitrogen you add. It's the grease, but it's oxygen is the most important thing you need for functioning of those roots. So we talked about it, and so Greg has sent me, Dan sent me a picture of, said, did he crack his soil properly? And yeah, that's the term we use. We use it a lot. It's a term I like. If you come up with a better one, you feel free to use it, but I like cracking. It's what we're doing. We're not tilling. We're cracking because we want to break up the hard pan that forms as a result of walking on the soils all the time, of all this rainfall. And there's a hard pan, what we call a hard pan. It's like a hard layer of soil. And people say to me all the time, ooh, I got sandy, I got clay in my soil. And I say, no, it's probably just sand. It's probably just sand that's been compacted about 3 to 4 inches down. And Carol at Babynet's asking me what to do about planting in clay. But, you know, Carol, it may or may not be clay. It may be sand. We can talk about it. You can feel free to call me. In either case, it's the same thing. But listen, crack that 3 to 4 inch layer. Everybody should start there by cracking, not tilling. And we just take a simple little fork and we wiggle it down and we lean back and we crack the soil. We don't try to turn it upside down. Don't try to do anything else. We just crack it. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about what that means after this break. Coming up, what? Right now, Charlie?
Yep,
here we go.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast sunny morning. And, you know, we're talking about, I hope you're with me, because we're talking about the basics. We're talking about the things you need to know to make your garden work, because I don't want you to have to listen to me all the time. I want you to understand this well enough that you can tell other people about it. And it's very basic. What we said was is that what your soil needs more than anything else, and it's oxygen. And how do we get that oxygen in there? That's the big problem. And so a couple of things. Carol, I'm so glad you called me, because you're right on cue, man. Excuse me, ma'am. You're right on cue. And you got the perfect question, but let me stop here just a minute, because I want to do things. Cracking is just a way of sort of jump starting the process. And so I always recommend, because we have damaged our soil so bad that the first thing we have to do to these soils is crack them, and that allows water to percolate deeper into the soil. It creates a reservoir in the soil. It sort of jump starts the whole process of oxygen moving into the soil. It doesn't complete it. It's not enough, but it can kind of jump start things. So we talk about cracking, which is cracking that very hard layer of soil that's about 3 to 7 inches down. Sometimes it's even shallower, 2 to 7 inches down, that's formed by all the crazy things we do to our soil. So we crack it to break that, and then you'll find that below that 7-inch layer, gosh, it's kind of easy to dig down here because that's below the hard pan, and that water just flows down into the soil, so you don't get a bunch of buildup on top of the soil. The water flows into the soil oftentimes. There's some exceptions, but it flows into the soil and perks on down, and then it serves as a reservoir because it gets wicked back up. But the second stage is you have to add organic matter. You have to add organic matter. There's so many reasons for that. Taxman calls pine bark permanent fluff. Well, it's not quite permanent, but it's an interesting thought there, Taxman. I like that idea. When you till your soil, you get this sort of temporary fluff, and it don't last very long, a couple of weeks. But if you can incorporate organic matter, if organic matter becomes part of that, and I'm not saying tilling it in, that's the wrong way to think about it. Leave it on the surface, topsoil on the top, organic matter on the top, amazing thing that you would leave the topsoil on the top. There it is. So you want to put that organic matter in there, and that becomes very, very important. That really helps. Carol, let's talk about this clay soil now.
Okay, some places I can crack the soil and it's fluffable, as you're saying. Other areas, when I dig for the deep enough for the root ball that I'm planting, it takes 7 hours. I put water in to see how it drains, and it takes up to 7 hours. So my solution was to add organic matter I get from the city, and make a hill and just put it a volcano around whatever I'm trying to plant.
Okay, good. So, yeah. So sometimes when you get into if the clay layer, and Carol, I think maybe we were talking about, maybe you lived on what was originally a pitcher plant bog, probably had a clay hard pan that was very hard, kind of a bowl.
That's, we have dead soil when I dig down into certain areas. I don't know if it was added when the house was built in the 70s or why there's these different soils in my yard.
Yeah, so it's right. And it could be added, but I suspect it's probably just you live on a hillside and some areas stay very wet and some areas don't. Is that the case?
Well, because I'm on a hill, I have good drainage.
Yeah. So it's probably a pitcher plant bog. I'm just going to bet. And what happens with a pitcher plant bog is there's a it happens naturally. There's a hard clay layer that's very thick that water doesn't perk through, and on top of that you get this sort of permanent flow of water that's just below the ground. The pitcher plants love that, but tomatoes don't. And you don't have the organic layer that's on top of that that would normally be part of the pitcher plant bog, so you've lost that, so you can't go back. You got to go forward. You're doing exactly the right thing. At a certain point, and this is very important in planting in our climate, and I got this problem in my yard in Midtown. And I'll tell you why, because the water table is so high for much of the year in my yard in Midtown, I could dig a post hole, and I dig down about 12 inches, and it starts filling up with water at certain times of year. So I got this very high water table that's there, and so there's no place for the water to drain to, and that's your problem too. So then you do have to start thinking about building up.
I don't notice water.
And here's the important thing to think about. Plants need about 6 inches. Plants are going to do okay with about 6 inches of well-oxygenated soil.
6 inches.
And if they get that, they're going to be okay. So you don't have to have this really deep, deep, deep topsoil. 6 inches is okay. And so one of the things that can work, not in every situation, but in most situations here along the Gulf Coast, if when you plant your plant, you leave, it's like I keep saying it's like you've taken a cork out of a wine bottle and you try to stuff it back in, but you never get it all the way in. It's kind of sitting above the ground just a little bit, sitting above the bottle cap. So that's what you want to do with most of your plants. That are in pots, in containers. Don't plant them so that all of the soil in that root ball is covered. Leave some of that root ball uncovered. You can leave 2 or 3 inches of that root ball out of the ground.
Okay.
And then build the organic matter up to it if you like. But dig a hole reasonably deep, but not as deep as the root ball. And then leave 2 or 3 inches of it above ground, and then bring your organic matter up and keep bringing that organic matter up. Now, I will tell you that there are some cases in which the clays can be so hard and which there is so little organic matter that it becomes impractical to do that over the long haul. But that is the most important thing you can do, is not to keep trying to dig down. Crack it the best you can, but don't dig deeper than the root ball. Allow the plant to sit a little bit above the ground level that's there now, and then bring the organic matter up to it. And that's exactly what you're talking about doing. I wouldn't make it, you know, Carol, are we on the same page so far?
Yes. I'm trying to do that, but I have to create these little islands.
I'm sorry, Carol, I can't.
Here and there where I'm planting things to. I dig in as much as I can without worry of creating the bathtub effect. And then I plant, put the root ball in, and then pour the soil around it, and it creates these little volcanoes or islands sitting here and there.
Yeah, so think of them as islands. I like the term islands because it's visually nicer to me and more appropriate than volcanoes. The volcanoes are too narrow. What you want is those roots to spread out as far as you can.
Okay.
So for healthy roots, they need to be spreading out 6 to 8 to 10 feet from the tree at least. That's really what you want to do. So think of them as islands of mulch around those trees that's about 3 to 6 inches deep. Okay?
Okay.
And let those roots grow into it. Now, I'll tell you, that mulch is going to break down over time. So you have to keep adding to it. It's not a hard thing to do. If you start out with pine bark,
I'm not worried about that.
Huh?
I'm not worried about the adding the mulch on top.
You always got plenty of it.
I've been successful with that. It's just taking care of this root ball.
Yep, and so just don't feel bad. In fact, the standard practice is recommended by University of Florida in this wet climate is with most plants, given the fact that the way they're grown in the nurseries, given the fact that a root ball is a pretty artificial thing anyway, never feel bad about leaving about 2 to 3 inches of that root ball exposed above ground.
Okay, I have done that, and I was worried that it was that the plant wasn't getting watered properly.
When you do, you always have to water the plant properly. But if you think about it, in a container, most of the roots are in the bottom of the pot anyway.
Okay.
That's just what happens. It's they're not quite at the bottom, but they're in the lower half. That's okay. Where most of the roots are. There's always relatively fewer roots in the very top of a container, and the oxygen rich zone is only about 6 inches deep anyway in the best of situations. So you want those roots to be in contact. You want the middle of the pot to be at the top of the soil, if you see what I'm saying.
Okay.
So never feel bad about that. It always works. Now, you are going to have to, in that situation, because you have no reservoir of water that it can wick up from below, you're going to have to water it frequently to get it established.
Okay. And then I'm worried about root rot.
Yeah, that's right. But you're solving that problem. You're solving that problem by keeping that pot raised. And by creating those little islands of mulch that sit slightly above everything else.
So I'm trying to create a ring so that I can put about 5 gallons of water in the ring.
Yeah, that works. Those little plastic rings that leak water out slowly. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I just do a
ring around the plant. I see,
yeah.
I see. And you could certainly do that, too. That's right. But here's the most important thing. If you've got five, most trees, you can establish them with, say, let's say about 10 gallons of water a week.
Okay.
If you get that water to the roots, that's
okay.
About all the roots need. But the roots are right there in one place. They're not, when it's new, the roots, you got to get the water right where the roots are. So if you put the water out on the edges where the roots aren't, then that water just goes into the ground or wherever else, but not to the roots. So you want to make sure, and that's why I recommend when you're starting a new plant, if you've just got a hose.
Okay.
You just let it drip. Just let it drip right there because all that water is going to the roots. It doesn't take a lot. They make these little collars, and they may be very useful to you. They're made out of plastic, and they're a kind of a inflatable, like something you'd put in the swimming pool and fill it up with air, except you fill them up with water, and you put them around your plants. I think I've seen them called gator bags is one trade name. There's other things, but you put them around your plants and they just drip that water very slowly. And you just go fill that bag up and you just let the bag do it.
I think I saw one.
Yep. And they can be very useful in your situation just for getting those plants established because they don't need a lot of water, but they need it at the roots, where the roots are when you're getting established. As the plant gets established, of course, you don't need to water very frequently. It's better not to water too frequently. But when they're getting established,
it takes a couple years for it to be truly established.
That's right. And I would say by next summer, they're going to be pretty well established if you take good care of them. If you're planting them now and you're doing this, by next summer, they should be really well established.
Okay, so 10 gallons a week for a year.
That's a decent number. It's not official, but it would probably work. But if you put one of those root collars on there and just fill it up once a week, you're probably going to be just fine.
Excellent. Thank you so much for holding our hand.
Carol, great. You call back anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, gosh, we got to take a break. I'm driving Charlie crazy.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right round all the seven oceans, drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's a sweet as Tupelo, honey.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, look at here. So Rusty's got to keep me on my toes. Yes, you're right, Rusty. I did need a qualification for that when I said that Mobile is the wettest city in the U.S. There's a couple of ways of looking at it. We probably are the wettest metro area in the U.S. And that includes all of the U.S. Another way of saying it is maybe we could say we're the wettest city. If you understand city to be major cities, and exclude everything outside the continent like Hilo, Hawaii, which is wetter. You know, there are several places wetter than Mobile, just to be fair. Cashiers, North Carolina is wetter. The San Juan Islands in Seattle, off Seattle, are wetter. But these are places where not many people live. There don't many people live there because it's too wet. There's not major cities, but listen, just let's leave it at this. In the continental U.S., in the contiguous U.S., there ain't much like Mobile. There people don't live in places this wet. Seattle Airport gets 35 inches of rain a year, 38 inches of rain a year. We get 70. Think about that, folks. Very few places get the kind of rainfall we get. New Orleans is similar, and the place between New Orleans and here, there are places along the Gulf Coast that get more than Mobile. They're just not, they're not in cities. They're not part of a city environment. But we get a lot of rain. That's the key point. And that's what, Rusty, it's good to keep me on my toes with this too, and to make me say it exactly right. So let's do that. Let's do that. Craig, I'm listening. What's up? Give me
30 seconds.
I don't have much time.
A fig tree about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's growing very, very well, and it's growing out into my driveway, so I wanted to air layer some of the lower branches off before I cut them off.
Yeah.
I want to know when the best time is to do that, or just any old time will do. And what should I use, like sphagnum moss or something?
I got 15 seconds, and here's what I'm going to tell you. The best time to do it with figs, you can air layer them anytime you want to. They just lay them down, just put some leaves over them, and they're going to air layer. There's some other ways to propagate figs. If you'll call me back, Craig, next week, I'll have more time to talk about it. But it's the easiest thing in the world to air layer those guys. Call me back next week. I will.
They're
making me shut up. It's good to hear y'all. We'll be back next week.